Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on Cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
The Broken Circle Breakdown chronicles a love-at-first-sight romantic relationship from beginning to end between a tattoo artist and a musician. An Academy Award nominee for foreign language film, it's available on demand 35 days before Netflix and Redbox. And also available on demand is Diana. Naomi Watts portrays the late Princess Diana in the last 2 years of her life.
The latest independent films are ready when you are, with Movies on Demand on Cable. The Art House is now in your house.
From New York City, this is Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. And coming up on this week's show, sex! 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 Other things too, but most importantly, sex! Sex, sex. As we review Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac, Volumes 1 and 2.
Later in the show, we'll bring you cue shots where we recommend some other titles you can rent or stream at home right now, all centered on a common theme. In honor of Nymphomaniac, we were going to do a whole episode about movies, about what, Allison? Explicit?
Sexuality?
Oh, I was hoping you might scream it again.
I didn't need to say my voice.
That's all right. But then I realized that my parents are dedicated listeners of this podcast. And when I have a phone call with them, they'll often say, oh, we just listened to the Noah episode. That was a good one. Or, you know, oh, we really enjoyed the discussion about antiheroes. And I realized, Allison, I just could not handle that phone call after an explicitly sexual movies podcast. Oh, we really enjoyed you describing the scene and In the Realm of the Senses that all had all the close-ups of the genitals. You know what movie we like to watch together? Body Heat. No. No. That is not happening. So instead, since it is December 7th as we're recording this, and we're about a week away or so from finalizing our top 10 films of the year lists, we thought we would talk some more about other notable films of 2014 that you can rent or stream at home right now. And hopefully there's not a lot of nudity or sex in any of them. But first up is Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight a few notable films new on demand on cable. Allison, what are our picks this week?
Sex!
Thank you.
No problem. Well, first up, new to On Demand and available now, is I, Origins, which is written and directed by Mike Cahill, who is the filmmaker behind Another Earth. And this film is similar in kind of feel. It's like, I suppose you could call it thoughtful, spiritual sci-fi.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like Another Earth, for
right?
sure.
It stars Michael Pitt as a molecular biologist who has been doing research into eyes, basically, and into eyes as
EYE eyes.
Yes, as an argument for evolution.
Okay.
You know, specifically, they're kind of looking at this project to find an eyeless species that has the genes that can be triggered to grow an eye and to see if they can grow an eye and basically kind of play God or demonstrate evolution. So obviously he is on the side of kind of like atheism and logic, and then he meets and falls in love with this free-spirited model who is spiritual, you know, who believes in God, who is also superstitious and kind of is his opposite. And the movie is a lot about these themes of faith versus logic, and also about the idea of reincarnation, and also it ties into eye research and all of these other themes and romance.
I go to 7-Eleven, I buy some stuff.
11-Eleven.
Lucky 11s. I look at the date, it's 11-11. I look at the time, it's 11-11. I start to see these 11s everywhere.
When I followed them, I found these eyes. I'd like to tell you the story of the eyes that changed this world.
Cahill's films have never quite clicked with me the way Zalabat Manglij, who kind of came up with him, and also has made films starring Britt Marling.
They both make films with Britt Marling, yeah.
The way that his have, but there's no denying his talent. Like, I, this is a movie that I think just has a gorgeous look, and it has huge ambition. I think that it didn't get as well received as Another Earth,
right,
which was like his breakout mm-hmm. and his first film, but it's still, I think it's a testament to the fact that he's really staked out a particular kind of movie that he's making his own. And, you know, it's got Britt Marling again. So they've managed to, and she also starred in Zalbet Manglij's second film. So it's kind of neat that they're all still working together and collaborating. So that's I, Origins. It is currently available on demand, as is Dying of the Light, which is directed and written by the great Paul Schrader, writer of Taxi Driver, director of American Gigolo, among many others.
Yes.
Not a guy who has had a great relationship with Hollywood recently.
No.
And this is the film that Schrader has been going public about with claims that the producers took the film away from him during the editing process, that the final result does not reflect his vision, that they recut it, they did the score. And he has
been sort of like campaigning against his own movie.
Right. Even though he has had to do it in a very particular way because he's got like a non-defamation clause in his contract. So it's been like him and star Nicolas Cage, co-star Anton Yelchin, and executive producer Nicholas Winding Refn all wearing T-shirts about this, but not saying anything to kind of, I suppose, get around that. But if you're curious about this movie as, you know, kind of great studio intervention, possible disasters can always be interesting. It stars Cage as Evan Lake, a CIA agent who is close to retirement, who is diagnosed with frontotemporal dementia and who goes rogue to follow up on evidence that the fundamentalists who tortured him years ago might still be alive. So that's Dying of the Light, and it is now available on demand. And finally, also available on demand is Starry Eyes, which is a low-budget horror film directed by Kevin Kolsch and Dennis Widmeyer that's gotten some really nice reviews, given that it's kind of coming from, it was a Kickstarter-funded movie, it's like no big stars. It's gotten some really kind of nice attention from horror sites and otherwise. And it's about an actress or aspiring actress named Sarah, played by Alex Esso, who is trying to make it in Hollywood and then gets her chance to star in a dark tale about the film industry called The Silver Scream. But Starry Eyes is itself a dark tale about the film industry. And so getting this part involves Sarah making a deal of sorts with possibly satanic forces in signing on to the job and slowly falling apart. And it's one, you know, I'm very curious about, and I do like a good satanic Hollywood movie. So all three of those are currently available on demand. I've been really trying, baby, trying to hold back this feeling for so long. And if you feel like I feel, baby, then come on. Get it on.
So our theme this episode, not really a theme, we are catching up with 2014 movies. It's basically a necessity here. This is what we are doing with our free time right now. I know last week, Allison, I saw two movies every night of last week. In most cases, like I would go to a screening right after work and then I would come home and watch a screener. We are fortunate enough to get screeners. I'm not complaining. Actually, it's fun. But that's, you know, there's a lot of movie watching going on right now and it's very focused. It's on the movies of the year because we've got to file these top 10 lists with various polls, and I'm in the Online Film Critics Society, and so we have like a deadline to submit our ballots, which was actually yesterday. Not for our final like a top 10 list, but you have to like vote on who our nominees are going to be. So we, you know, no one's forcing us, but we want to have the most authoritative and the most comprehensive lists that we can. We want to be able to say that we've seen all the big movies and as many of the small movies as we can. So that's what we're doing. I guess we could talk in a general sense about the year in movies, but I don't know. I
think we can save that for next time.
We could save that for next time as well. I also find it kind of silly. I used to probably buy into it more, but it's like, you know, it was a good year for movies. Every year is a good year for movies,
well,
really.
I think also, clear, like this year there are going to probably be what, like over 900 new theatrical releases.
Well, that's the thing. That's why it's like, always a good year for
your year in movies might look totally different from my year in movies.
True. And also there's so many movies now that it's hard to have a bad year when you have so many to choose from and there's so many out there.
Do you know how many you'll have seen by the end of the year?
The last, I use Letterboxd like our colleagues at Film Spotting Original Recipe. I don't think we don't really publicize it as much on the show, but I log every movie I see there. If people want to follow me, I think my handle there is letterboxd.com/superpulse, and you can follow along with everything that I'm seeing. And I think I'm edging up on, at this point, like, I'm like in the 330 range, so I'll probably be close to like three. Some of those are older movies. That's okay. Like everything. Every movie I've watched doesn't necessarily have to be a 2014 film. I don't know how many 2014 films yet. I haven't kept a list of that. I could probably figure it out. But in terms of older and newer, yeah, it's probably going to wind up being around 350. Yeah, what about you?
I think for just new releases 2014, I'm probably going to end the year around 175.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't watch many things in January because I was covering TV. So
right, you didn't switch over.
I had like
beats.
3/4 of a year. So mm-hmm. I've been doing some, not like a lot of that many great movies came out around then.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so I feel like it's not as many as the last year I covered film regularly, but it's still a lot of movies.
It's a lot of movies, but a lot of them are very good. So that's, I mean, I wouldn't say that the movies we're going to recommend today are necessarily going to be on our top 10 lists. But they're obviously good movies that we like that we think are worth seeing, maybe before you fill in your own top 10 list at home or just are looking for good stuff to watch. Allison, do you want to go first?
Sure. I'll start with one that actually very well might be on my top 10 list.
Oh, spoiler alert.
Yeah.
By the way, we haven't said yet. We'll be doing full lists and the Spoovy Awards and all that good stuff on our next episode. So, but okay, go ahead.
All right. So my pick is Ida, I guess Ida, if you are going with
they
the
pronounce
English
it Ida in
the
movie
film. Yeah, which is currently streaming on Netflix and on Amazon Prime, the new film from Paweł Pawlikowski, who is Polish but has spent most of his life in the UK, where some of his earlier movies like Last Resort and My Summer of Love were set. But Ida finds him returning to Poland in the 1960s, where the title character, who's like an 18-year-old novice nun who grew up in the convent's orphanage under the name Anna, is told that she needs to visit her one surviving family member, her Aunt Wanda, who is a judge and a powerful figure in the communist Soviet bloc state that Poland had become after the war. Wanda tells Anna that her name's actually Ida, she's a Jew, and that their family died in the war, and the two set out to find the grave of her parents, who suffered, you know, the terrible fate of most of Poland's Jewish population, only they didn't even make it to the camps. They died elsewhere. And part of the story, it's a road trip movie, and it's also a mystery of sorts mm-hmm. in investigating
what happened to the parents.
Yep. Yeah. And I mean, among many other pleasures in this film, the cinematography is just exquisite. Like, it's this black and white, just like, but like, I don't know, pearly looking almost. And the leads both have great faces. Agata Kuleska.
Come on, you can do it.
Kuleska.
Yeah.
Kulesa. Okay, let's say Kuleska, who is Wanda. And then particularly Trzebukowska, who is Ida, and who has this very, she looks like a painting a lot. She often is wearing like a nun's, I don't know what that is. It's not really a wimple yet, but a head covering mm-hmm. For the novice nun. And she just has this very kind of like, I don't know, like a portrait, a face that looks like it would be on an old portrait, like this kind of very like round, like meditative looking face. And I like just the way that it's shot, mostly with still cameras, oftentimes putting the characters at the bottom of the frame as if kind of suggesting that, I don't know, like the contemplation of God almost.
Yeah, there's a lot of headroom in the shot. If you imagine the normal framing, imagine almost like twice as much headroom as you would give to a normal traditional film. And yeah, it definitely suggests the divine or perhaps the absence of the divine
exactly.
as well,
which
because
like
there's
the
nothing
major,
up there. Yes.
Right, which is like one of the major questions in the film,
right?
Yeah,
it's really fascinating and very striking choice.
Yeah, you know, that one of the undercurrents of the film is the idea of the like contemplation of God or the absence of God it, you know, in this country that is returned to a sort of normalcy after this just horrendous, this horrendous time that saw so many horrendous actions, including like this, the time after the Aunt Vonda participated in these show trials that in which, you know, anti-communist accused anti-communist forces were, you know, sent off to sometimes terrible ends themselves. But that just all of the like the people who committed some of these atrocities who have just gone on back into normal life. I mean, a lot of the film is about the kind of awfulness of normalcy returning as it inevitably does, that the world does not end, that people just act like these things didn't happen. What's, you know, I think there's one point where a character is like, it's the past now, you know, essentially like urging, like, leave this person alone. And you're like,
let,
well,
it go, get over it.
Let it go. And you're like, but this, like, it's too horrible to let go.
Teraz to już nikim. Ale kiedyś byłam prokuratorem. Duże publiczne procesy. Wysłałam nawet kilka osób na śmierć.
It's a very deceptively simple film. It really is. It's, I think, like 80 minutes long. And it consists really of this road trip and then the aftermath. But it's so eloquent in these very simple scenes. There, it allows you to fill in what the characters are feeling and also their state of mind, I think, in a way that's incredibly effective. And kind of as it complicates each of the women, Vonda is this hard-drinking, chain-smoking, promiscuous woman who also, you know, almost relishes the power that she had and is very open about the fact that she, you know, essentially kind of like, it's almost spite that, like,
yeah, I was gonna say, it's almost like she's taking revenge.
She's taking revenge,
right?
And then Ida is this something close to a blank slate in the beginning. She's had this very, very sheltered life and has this forceful brush with not just the reality of what happened to her family, but also of outside life, including, you know, she meets a boy, she sees life in the country, throughout the country, having not gone anywhere at all. It's hard to make a film that sounds as simple as this, to describe how I think like all of the complexities that arise from it. But mm-hmm. I think it really does that. It does that. It allows them to unfold in a way that's very, that just works so well. You know, it's, this movie is definitely worth your time, and I think it is one of the best films of the year. It certainly really like had an impact on me. And that is Ida, and it is currently streaming on Netflix and Amazon Prime.
All right, it's a fine choice. I have to say, I wasn't crazy about the aftermath of the road trip. Mm-hmm. Didn't really care for those scenes.
Yeah, I know some. I've seen a few other people mention that, but I like
you
them
like
a lot.
Them. Okay.
Yeah,
yeah, that would be the one part that I would say holds it back for, like, you know, for that film being on like my top 10 list. But yeah, a very interesting film, and particularly that cinematography is definitely some of the year's best, for sure, for sure. If you're a cinematography nerd, that is definitely one that's not to be missed. All right, my first pick is actually one of our losing listeners' choice options from our last episodes. But there are no losers here on Film Spotting SVU, Allison. There are only non-winners, I guess. It is called Stranger by the Lake. And now I get to pronounce a name that I can't pronounce. And it is the director's name. I'm going to guess it's Alain Jouiradi, maybe. And the film is streaming on Netflix. And you can also rent this film on Amazon. And I was just, you know, after hearing about it, when we talked about it before our last episode, it sounded really interesting. And so, you know, even before we found out which film had won, actually, for this episode, I had already watched it. I watched it last weekend, and I definitely enjoyed it and decided it would be worth recommending. It is, you know, sort of like Ida, it is sort of a mystery. In this case, it's sort of a murder mystery, but the identity of the murderer is never in question. So it's not a traditional murder mystery, and it's set entirely on this secluded beach by a lake in France. And this is a spot where gay men go to sunbathe and skinny dip and also to cruise. The woods around the beach are full of men hooking up in fairly graphic ways. There is a lot of male nudity in this movie, more, I would say, than, I don't know, almost any movie I've ever seen in my life, actually. The main character here is a man named Frank. He goes to this beach basically every day to swim, to hook up. And over the course of the film, he forms these two relationships. One with an older and out of shape guy named Henri, he claims he's not gay. He claims he's just broken up with a wife that we never see. And that he comes to the beach for like peace and quiet and solitude and things like that. And the other guy is named Michel. He's very young. He's very handsome. He's a great swimmer. He has a kicking mustache. And now, so basically the day that Frank meets Michel, they have this conversation. They kind of hit it off. They're sort of flirting. And then they're interrupted by a jealous lover of Michelle's. And then the next day, Frank stays late at the beach and then watches from a distance. He's sort of on the shore as Michelle kills this other character, the lover character, like drowning him in the water. We watch this all happen. It's all in this one incredible long take. There's not really any doubt. There's no, you know, like there's no question of what's happened. But Frank is like attracted to him anyway. And he begins to spend more and more time with him at the beach and to sleep with him. And then a police detective starts snooping around trying to figure out if the guy who's died drowned accidentally or was drowned on purpose. And then without spoiling what happens after that, Frank has to sort of decide to tell the truth about what he knows. He has to decide whether to confront Michelle about what he's seen or to not do either of them because he's so attracted to this guy.
Tu restes toujours à l'écart, donc on peut dire que t'as envie de voir personne. Si t'avais envie de pas rester seul, ben t'irais voir les gens.
Mais comment je fais?
Ben tu veux les voir. Tu discutes avec eux.
Oh, ça c'est de la drague.
Ben tu viens bien ici un peu pour ça, non?
Non.
You would probably classify Stranger by the Lake as a thriller. It has a lot of thrillerish elements, and the end is also very thrillerish. But I actually preferred it not even so much as a thriller as like a portrait of desire. As a thriller, it's a little languidly paced. I wanted to say sluggish. It's not sluggish. It's more languid. It's like it's very deliberately kind of placid, like the water of the lake, perhaps you might say. But as a portrait of desire, it's very interesting because these characters are so interesting. You know, the guy who's drawn to this man, he knows that he's done something horrible, but he sort of can't resist that character of that older guy who he claims not even to be gay, but he's just sitting there. And so like, why is he sitting there day after day? And then, you know, the Michelle character who's killed someone and we don't even really know why. And we're left to sort of puzzle it all out. And so the kind of dance of these characters and their feelings about one another are really, really interesting.
I've seen someone describe this as an AIDS metaphor.
That's so funny you said that because yeah. In my notes, that was the next thing I had, is that there also perhaps is something of an AIDS metaphor in here, that this idea of being attracted to someone and this, you know, perhaps this fear of what having sex with them could potentially do. Yeah, absolutely. That is very much there. And I found all of that fascinating. And you know, it's another very well-shot movie. It's not quite as striking as Ida, but the lake is really beautiful. And, you know, the kind of dreamy atmosphere of this lake, which seems sort of out of space and time in a certain sense, is very, you know, kind of interesting. And the whole movie is set there. We never go anywhere else. It's like sort of a procession of days going on and on and on at this lake. So have you seen it? Or
I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I'd say it's worth checking out. Again, probably not one that would make my list, but it's definitely a very, very interesting film. So that's Stranger by the Lake, and that is streaming now on Netflix, and you can also rent it on Amazon.
All right, my next pick is not going to make my top 10, but I do think it's an interesting movie that's half a success and half a mess. And it also kind of got lost in the shuffle, I think, in this year. So I wanted to remind everyone that it exists. It is The Congress.
Oh, I thought you were going to say I, Frankenstein.
I know. No, how could anyone forget that exists? Yo, Frankenstein. It's The Congress, which is available for rent on all of the usual platforms and is the latest film from Ari Folman, who directed the really terrific Waltz with Bashir. And like that film, this one combines animation with live action, but it's just much, much weirder. It stars Robin Wright as a version of herself who is kind of both more and less successful than actual Robin Wright is. This Robin became this huge breakout star because of The Princess Bride, which is a movie that's repeatedly like looked at. This poster of her, her face is giant in it, becomes this symbol for her youthful promise. And then she earned a reputation for herself for being flaky and difficult, for always dropping out of projects right when they're about to go into production, and, you know, saying that she needs to go spend time with her kid or all of these other things. And when the movie starts, she's living near an airport in a converted hangar that's actually made into a really sweet house with her two kids. One is a sassy teenager, and the other, played by Cody Smith McPhee, is suffering from Usher syndrome. So, and is gradually losing his hearing and sight. And Robin gets an offer from Miramount Studios, which is run by the sleazy Jeff Green, played by Danny Houston, for the last role she will ever play. She will be fully scanned in, just scan all of her, you know, expressions.
She'll be scanned, like in Scanners? Michael Ironside will scan her?
It's like, yeah. I'd be like, I got the last role for you. Boom. No, she will be scanned in what's this like high-tech motion capture machine. It will capture all of her emotions, all of her image, and then she will sign her rights away. She will sign, like, Robin Wright, the actress, as a digital performer
will
away.
Become a CGI character.
Yes, but doesn't look like a CGI character.
It looks exactly like her.
To Miramount Studios, and she is not allowed to act ever again. Because they own her as an actor now.
Right,
her character,
right. Her avatar.
They own her character. And so she will retire.
The minute the studio pays and scans, the actor isn't an actor. He's just a person, a nobody. And the actor he once was is, from now on, a character in the studio's computer.
The studio can do whatever they want, unless the lawyer puts a clause in saying that they can't. So it's very tricky, very tricky. It's a new field. We're on the cusp.
So what happens to the actor?
What actor?
The one that used to be the actor and is now this computer creature.
He goes off to play golf somewhere.
And what if he doesn't like golf?
From the kind of decision going up to that, then the movie leaps forward 20 years into a future in which people can take chemicals that allow them to see the world as this malleable thing. Basically, where they can see the world as animated. And the second half of the movie is almost entirely animated. It's this universe where basically you can, like, I don't know, drink a drink and it makes you temporarily look like someone else, where there's just outrageous, trippy visuals. It looks like a giant acid trip. And then it kind of gets more complicated from there. And I think that there are parts of this movie that don't really work. Like, I think it's a little incoherent in terms of how the argument it wants to make about going from removing the person from performance and then eventually removing all other people from it to have it be this kind of product that is, in the end, controlled by the viewer, and then how it kind of links that into entertainment as this escape or kind of narcotic that takes us away from the real experience of the world. It brings up a lot of interesting thoughts on that, but doesn't really link them together, and I think doesn't have them as a whole. But actually, the first half of this movie is a very striking meditation on being an actress, and also on how much control you ever have over your image. You know, Robin Wright, the character, gets very upset about having her choices taken away from her. And her agent is like, well, when did you ever have control over this? You know, you're acting in other people's projects. If you ever took significant time off, people forget you exist. You know, you, as soon as you reach 35, you had to start, you know, making sure that you didn't look like you were aging, that you have never had full control of anything, that you have always been kind of buffeted by this industry, that the idea that you would turn over your image to someone else who put you in whatever projects they felt like, that isn't really, is basically a natural extension of the life of being
It's not that much of a stretch.
Right. But of also like the life of being an actor who has to be in other people's projects. But this movie fits in very well with this, one of the themes of this year in movies, which has been about the idea of wanting to make serious art versus commercial art. You've seen in things like Birdman,
Whiplash,
Sils Maria, which is not coming out until next year, but was, you know, at Cannes. There's and more, but there are a lot of top five.
Yeah, Chris Rock movie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That there are a lot of movies in which there are literally about performers who.
Wrestling with this idea.
And also who are who feel trapped by commercial pressures.
Yes.
And there's a part in the Congress where
Big Eyes is another one, by the way.
Oh, that's good. Where you see that you see this sci-fi movie. She's very anti-sci-fi. She doesn't ever want to be put in a sci-fi movie, but when she signs her digital rights away, she's put in this sci-fi
franchise. She has no choice.
Franchise, and you see the movie a little bit, and it's of course ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But it really reminded me actually of moments in several movies this year, and it's just been an interesting ongoing theme.
The trip to Italy, another one.
Yeah.
Listen up, Philip.
Exactly.
I'm just looking at the list of things I've watched recently and
about
finding even more
the
of them.
Tortured
about,
artist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actress.
Actress. Yes. Yeah. Frank.
Frank. Absolutely. So, I think that. This movie does not hold together, but it is very, it's got so many provocative ideas.
You're sort of recommending it as kind of a noble misfire.
Yes, I would say that.
An intriguing
and
misfire.
Certainly the idea of a movie that goes from being taking place in the real world-ish to diving into an entirely like Yellow Submarine style animated,
right.
You know, adventure, a dystopian storyline. You know, you can't fault it for ambition by any means.
Mm.
So that is The Congress, and it is available for rent on the usual platforms.
All right. I haven't seen that one, but it is one I do want to try to see. Hopefully, I'll have a chance to see it before the end of the year. My final pick here is the latest film from director Joe Swanberg, it's one of the latest,
He's
I guess.
He's probably made three more.
Let's be honest. Joe Swanberg is very prolific. He has probably made two or three more movies since he made this one, but it's at least the most recent one that you can find online. It's Happy Christmas, and it is streaming on Netflix, and you can rent it on iTunes and Amazon. And it's about a family in Chicago, and Joe Swanberg plays the husband, the father. Melanie Lynskey plays the wife, the mom. And Swanberg's real-life son, Jude, plays their two-year-old toddler baby. I don't know what the technical term is. And he is impossibly adorable. Women, there should be like a warning on this because I think he could make like women's ovaries hurt. He is so cute in this movie, and he's just great. He's very spontaneous. Clearly he doesn't know that he's acting. He's playing with his real dad, and they're filming it, and it has this wonderful, adorable, naturalistic quality. He's very funny and charming and cute and great. But he's not the focus of the film. He's just kind of like the scene stealer. The focus is Joe Swanberg's character's sister, who's played by the great Anna Kendrick. She has just had this rough breakup with a boyfriend. And so just before Christmas, it is set around Christmas, and that makes it a good movie to watch right now in December. She decides to come to Chicago to live with her brother and his family in their basement while she kind of gets back on her feet, figures out what she wants to do next. And since this is a Joe Swanberg movie, that's about it. It's not a lot of story. It's a movie about relationships and dialogue and, you know, low-key, naturalistic humor, not necessarily the plot. Kendrick's character, she certainly drinks too much. She might be an alcoholic. They don't really ever kind of stamp it with that kind of label. But she has a drinking problem on her hands. She's getting high a lot. She meets this guy played by Mark Webber, who's sort of a occasional babysitter and also pot dealer. And Melanie Linsky's character worries that maybe Anna Kendrick, she shouldn't be living with them because she might not be responsible enough. She could endanger the baby. That's sort of a recurring theme throughout the film. And she might be right. The other kind of recurring thread is the Linsky character. She is a struggling writer. She's put aside her career at the moment to take care of the baby. But when Anna Kendrick arrives, she sort of encourages her to get back to work along with her friend, who's played by Lena Dunham in a very funny, small supporting role. And her suggestion, this is again Anna Kendrick's suggestion, is, well, why just write something? If you guys are kind of struggling monetarily, you should write something commercial. You should write like a sexy novel, like an erotic romance novel because you're talented enough to do it. You could write it and you'd make a lot of money and that would make things easier for you. So some of the best scenes in the movie are Linsky, Kendrick, and Dunham sitting around in an office like hashing out the plot of the movie and also the right words. Like, how are they going to use, what words are they going to use to describe parts of the male and female anatomy? And those scenes are really, really funny.
Are you saying this? Just sit down for a couple of days, write an erotic novel, sell it for a gazillion dollars, and all my problems are solved?
Yes. Kind of.
5 or 6 things to bring up. It's not that I don't think I could, even with your expertise, it's very difficult to make a lot of money selling a book. It's not like I would write it and someone would just be like, oh, here's my millions for you.
It's like your stuff is so beautiful. And then if there was like, you know, if there was sex in it, I would be so excited. I would buy like 5 copies and give them to my friends, or plan to give them to my friends, and then keep them for myself because it would be my favorite book ever.
Oh, God. You are really,
this is a great idea.
I honestly don't think that the movie is like a major step forward for Joe Swanberg. It's probably actually more like his earlier stuff than something like Drinking Buddies was, which was like his 2013 movie that had a very big cast. It had Kendrick, but it also had Olivia Wilde and Jake Johnson and Ron Livingston. And that to me felt a little bit bigger and closer to like a mainstream indie film. And I actually didn't like that one that much. I think this one is better. I think there's, I don't know, it just feels a little bit realer and a little more autobiographical. I think that the stuff about Linsky's character I really liked. And I was wondering, because Joe Swanberg's wife, Chris, I believe her name is a filmmaker in her own right.
Yeah.
And they have this kid. We're looking at their real kid in the movie. So I'm sure this sort of like weighing their careers is
she has a movie in Sundance.
I was just going to say that. that I'm sure that's a big part of their lives right now, and that she has a movie that's in Sundance next month. So I think that aspect of it, I think, is very well observed and very interesting. And, again, it is a small film. It's slight, but it has a lot of good stuff in it. And I mean this as a compliment. It feels kind of like a home movie. It's very intimate. It feels very real. It feels very natural. You have Swanberg as the dad playing with his son. And it's wonderful to watch them together. And I think, like, you know, kind of that good home movie quality is sort of what you want from a Joe Swanberg movie. So if you've seen his earlier movies and like them, I do think you'll like this. If you're not a fan, you probably won't like this one as well. But I, as a longtime fan, I enjoyed this one. I felt like kind of a return to form for me. It is Happy Christmas, and it is streaming on Netflix, and you can rent it on iTunes and Amazon.
Interrupt here. What you were doing when you walked down that corridor, you were reading the river. Most of the large fish stay sheltered from the current to save energy and to hide from the prey. Where the fish hides in the stream entails a very complicated hierarchy. The topography decides where the most attractive places are, and the biggest fish choose the best positions.
Now's the time on Film Spotting SVU where we review a film or television show chosen by you guys, the listeners, via our listeners' choice poll. The 3 options you had last time were Lars von Trier's 2-part film Nymphomaniac. I got to pronounce his name again. Alain Jouiradi's Stranger by the Lake, which we already talked about, and Jim Mickle's Cold in July. And that was the order they came in the poll, Allison. Nymphomaniac came in first place with about 45% of the vote. Stranger by the Lake got 35%, and Cold in July was in third place with about 20%. Okay, so that means it is Nymphomaniac we are talking about on this episode. Originally designed as a single 325-minute uncut and unedited epic, it was released here in the United States in 2 truncated parts. Combined volumes 1 and 2 run about 240 minutes, so almost a full hour and a half shorter. Can you imagine that, Allison?
I really can't.
Than the original cut. Still, the shortened Nymphomaniac does not lack for incidents or for graphic sexuality. Much of it involves the titular sex addict Joe, played in her younger years by Stacey Martin, and in her middle age by von Trier fixture Charlotte Gainsbourg. Her tale is structured as a series of chapters in a story told by the older Jo to a man named Seligman, played by Stellan Skarsgård, who finds her bloody and bruised in an alley. And when she refuses medical help, Seligman brings her back to his shabby apartment, and she begins to recount her journey to his doorstep from her early days, competing with a friend for men's affections on a long train ride, to her experiences as a debt collector of sorts for an underworld gangster type played by Willem Dafoe. Nymphomaniac proceeds in a generally chronological fashion, but it pauses for many digressions, mostly from Seligman, who will compare Joe's exploits to classical music or movements of Western religion, or most frequently, the behavior of animals. And her luring of men with her feminine wiles is, for example, compared, yes, to fly fishing. How she will feign weakness in the same way that a fly fisherman will shake their conveniently named nymphs in a way that suggests distress or illness, which gets the fish even more interested in catching their prey. So, Allison, this metaphor, the fish, the bait, the fisherman, would seem to have an additional use for our purposes. I think it's possible to read us, the audience, as the fish, the movie as the bait, and Lars von Trier as the fisherman looking to hook us with this tale of lust and violence and regret. So, my question to you is this: did you take the bait?
Well, I suppose the question is then, what is he trying to lure us into? Mm-hmm. Outrage, I don't know, titillation.
Attraction.
Yeah, you know, or...
Horror.
Or anger, you know,
yeah.
A bit. Like, he's always
outrage.
Been very... Yeah, he's always been very aware of the fact that I mean, many of his films have been both about women, but also about terrible things happening to women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's gotten accused of misogyny, which is not something that I believe to be the case, but that he's had a lot of self-awareness about. I mean, Antichrist is basically maybe his most successful provocation in terms of pushing at that button, right, of being like, is this misogynist, or is this actually the most non-misogynist?
Right.
You know, is it about misogyny?
I like the visual you're creating of like the kid who's like not touching someone.
Exactly.
It's like, does this bug you? Does this bug you? I'm not touching you.
It's exactly like that.
Yeah.
I feel like this movie attempts to do some of that, certainly, but in a way that's so much more diffuse by its very nature. It's spread out over, in this version we've watched, 4 hours. And obviously can be spread out over even more hours if you care to pursue that version. I think that it makes it a little less like an obvious provocation, because it simply can't be like that all of the time. It has to allow for, you know, in a lot of ways he often switches back and forth between scenes in which it's seemingly sincere and straightforward and scenes that are almost like deliberately artificial and stylized and kind of provocative.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I don't know, I feel like in this case the movie spent a little more time overall in that sincerity. But I will say this, of the 2 hours, I've seen part one praised more.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I liked part two better.
Really?
Yes. I think that it, as much as it was the darker part, they're both kind of dark, but
yeah.
The darker part, grimmer things happen to Joe.
Yes.
It also, I felt, got more at... It's like the movie snapped together a lot more, you know, in terms of this idea of whether or not there's moralizing to be done, and whether or not nymphomania is something... Her nymphomania, as she so insists on calling it, not sex addiction, it's nymphomania,
yeah,
is something that needs to be fixed. You know, even
right.
as it renders her unable to really fit into normal society.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. What do you feel like this movie ultimately made a point about her nymphomania, or did it kind of pull the rug out too many times?
Yeah, it's funny that that's how you chose to answer my question, because that is sort of something that I was wrestling with as I was watching this thing. Is like, what is the point? What is he going after? Yes, there's a lot of, you know, Lars von Trier is a brilliant filmmaker, so there's obviously a lot of craft and style and cleverness, but it's like, to what purpose? And I know what you're getting at. We certainly don't want to spoil anything about the ending, but the ending kind of frames things in a way that there's some interesting stuff to the ending, and
not even the ending, but also the point in which she, as she says, turns to the dark side. Right.
Yeah. It's funny. I did not like the second half more. I disliked the second half more. I found it kind of like just overly punishing. I just was just so ceaselessly bleak that I just was like kind of hoping that the end would come, you know, that I just kind of couldn't wait for it to be over in a lot of senses. But then towards the very end, when there's this sort of this key conversation between the Seligman character and her about what she's done and whether it was really wrong, and you know, there's talk about gender and like if this story had been about a man, what would we think about it? And all that sort of stuff, I think, is interesting. And I think it does make it in a certain sense kind of timely, because there's a lot of kind of talk about those sorts of gender roles and issues going on right now that I think puts it into the conversation. But the thing is, when you do that at the very end of the movie, kind of as almost like a gotcha or a twist or a...
And also, he undermines it right away.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The very end, I hated. I should say that. Yes. The very last thing in the movie, I really loathed very strongly. But that those sort of the talk, I found kind of interesting. But again, when you've sat through four hours of movie, and not really addressed that until the very ending, you've missed the opportunity to have me think about it for 4 hours. You know what I mean? Like, throwing it in at the end, okay, fine. But I probably would have maybe enjoyed it more if I had that sort of thought going through my mind the whole film.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason that the first part was less successful for me is that I don't feel like it really gave me a sense of the lack of control that she had, that it, you know, that later it becomes something where it becomes this giant thing that she has to grapple with in being like, I can't hold down a relationship. I can't be a mother.
Right.
I can't have a regular job.
Right.
You know, that.
Well, and that also undercuts kind of what I don't think it's a spoiler to say that his, you know, like what to comfort this character, the Joe character, Seligman is sort of like, you know, if this was a man doing these things, we wouldn't think anything of it. And there's certainly a truth to that. But like, this character is not just promiscuous. It's like, you know, she talks about having like sex with like 10 men in one night. Like it goes beyond promiscuous into like addiction
and compulsion.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like I think that kind of, again, undermines his argument, or perhaps the film's argument in a way.
Sure. But I think that it also actually digs into the question of being like, what if you, like, when you don't actually, like, who you are for whatever reason does not fit into the normal bounds of society.
Right.
Even like, if you want to address it along the lines of like mental illness or something like
right.
that, where you're like,
just feeling like a misfit or an outsider.
You will not, you cannot fit yourself into a normal place in society.
Right.
That like the ways in which we moralize that or don't, you know, that, I mean, her sex addiction, certainly by the second half, does not look in any way sexy.
No,
you know,
no.
It is, it's very not.
No.
It's, in fact, it's disgusting at times when she's like dealing with the physical realities of like what, you know, she like of like having that many lovers at a time and all of that, or like it has a toll.
Yes, it like physically takes a toll.
It takes a toll in a way that's very unpleasant.
Yeah,
you know, but that it, I feel like as much as, I don't know, you use the word punishing, but I do feel like you needed that part to balance out, you know, like the first half of the movie, for whatever it's worth, is like the more easily, like, she's a young girl having all of the sex, she has all of these lovers, right? She and suddenly when you turn that around and be like, it's an ugly compulsion, you know, it's one that when she wants to let it go, she can't let it go. Mm. That like, and there are downsides as well. I mean, I felt like that was more meaningful than the like sexy times, you know, the storylines of the first half.
When you talk about the film and this character and her addiction as a sort of metaphor for just being like an outsider or a misfit, I think that's interesting. And I'm sure that's probably something that Lars von Trier himself, you know, who's a guy who's grappled with mental illness and recently
addiction,
came out and saying that
yeah.
he has all these addiction issues and that he's never basically made something sober before this, and it took 18 months to do, and he doesn't know if he can continue his career without the drugs and alcohol that he used to sort of fuel his creativity. I think you're absolutely hitting on something that the movie is about and that was interesting to him. I think that's fascinating. I will say, though, watching the movie, I found to be just like a brutal, punishing, unpleasant experience. And I didn't really think about that stuff very much because I was just so... Honestly, at times I was even bored, which is kind of shocking because it is Lars von Trier and it is, you know, graphic sexuality. But I, you know, like when your main actors are like Shia LaBeouf and Christian Slater with terrible accents, I really found myself struggling through a lot of the sections of this movie where I was just like, ugh, I just don't want to be watching these people.
Yeah. Well, briefly, where would you say it was set?
Where's the movie set?
Yeah.
Like what? Place?
Yes.
That's an interesting question. It seems to be set in England, I
yes,
guess, because
maybe.
they all have British accents.
British-ish accents.
Yes.
Because
ish.
The lead is, I think she's Danish? Stacey Martin, who plays Jo in the first half, who is like...
She has an accent.
An unknown actress or like a model who was scouted for this. But yeah, she has an accent that's not British, really. And a lot of other people have accents that are not... They're just accents, but they're not necessarily consistent across the board.
Wikipedia, which is never wrong, says Stacey Martin is a Franco-English actress.
Franco-English.
So she certainly doesn't have a traditional English accent.
Right.
And then, but yeah, then you have a lot of American actors sort of putting on sort of British accents, like Shia LaBeouf, like Christian Slater. They're horrible.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that von Trier can be a very visual filmmaker. Like Melancholia does some like
stunning,
splendidly like gorgeous.
Yes.
And that there's no interest in that in this movie. This movie, I mean, it's episodic, like by definition, it's in chapters, but it just trudges through these stories in a way where there seems to be very little interest in how kind of well or how like kind of neatly they're put together or how they look, you know. I mean, there are some moments in which that Jo goes with her father, played by Christian Slater, and looks at trees, and I think those are like the moments of like prettiness in it. But for the most part, it's an ugly looking movie, not even in a sense that it's deliberate, but in a sense of indifference.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that kind of threw me.
It seems to be sort of I thought he was focusing less on like you're saying, like that visual splendor or striking images, and more on like the editing, the juxtapositions, you know, with the fly fishing and the luring of men. Or there's that one sequence that I did find kind of interesting about the polyphony, the three different sort of lovers that created this kind of chord, and the screen becomes kind of split in three ways. And there's a lot of examples like that. I felt like he was playing more with editing and juxtapositions. That seemed to be more where his focus lied. Cutting back and forth between the current story and the storytelling and the flashbacks and creating some very dark humor there and things like that.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of the rest of those scenes are just so kind of like straightforwardly shot, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. I appreciated that there were... as we got towards like some of the darker moments, it does have like the framing of the scene in which Jo picks up two African laborers.
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that.
That scene is very, it's really funny. It's very funny that when she's sitting on the bed and they're talking, and the way I won't go into because I feel like you have to experience it yourself, but the way it's framed is deliberately pretty entertaining.
But then what did you think about
that scene?
And also it seemed to me like Lars von Trier at the end of that scene was kind of using, because Charlotte Gainsbourg's character is like sort of describing these men in kind of politically incorrect terms, and then suddenly goes off on this rant that political correctness is destroying democracy, which to me felt like Lars von Trier sort of he had that whole issue at Cannes a few years ago where he said some dumb things and got in a lot of trouble, and it just seemed out of nowhere. It seemed sort of this insertion of his
I mean, it seemed,
his trying to personal views get in there. It just seemed totally random to me.
Yeah, it seemed like kind of more like, it seemed a little lazy to me, like a lot of it.
Catty,
what he said at Cannes, which was just like, I mean, he wasn't even, he made like just a stupid on the fly comment to provoke people about Nazis.
Yes.
It wasn't like clever. It wasn't anything he was invested in, you know? And I feel like that's the worst part about that whole the press conference debacle is
right.
That you're like, you just said something stupid to get a rise out of people, and it was more stupid than usual.
Yeah.
And I don't know, the whole part, the movie treats interracial sex like another kink.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that that's a not beyond just PC. That's just like a terrible thing to say.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't think we get a real sense that Joe is particularly forward thinking in terms of that either.
No, maybe not.
Yeah. So, but I don't know. I thought this, that way that scene was handled, like going into it, was very funny. The idea that she has to hire an interpreter.
Right. And that, I mean, it's sort of funny, but yeah, that,
but that also
the issues
she,
around
she's
it.
Got like a fantasy of it being this like violation, right? That she wants this thing where she has no control, she can't communicate.
Right.
And that what turns out is like kind of weird slapstick instead.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess. But yeah, the issues you're raising and that are around it, I found sort of kind of,
well, I mean, that's part, right,
accessible.
of the whole montage of penises at one point where she's talking about the many she's encountered.
Yeah. I'm sure someone who is more of a fan of the movie can explain why he cast Americans with really bad British accents to play what seem like British characters. Why not just cast British actors? I'm sure he could explain it. You know, either Lars von Trier could explain it or a defender of the movie could explain it. I did find that totally baffling. I mean, it is a very, I keep using the word like punishing, you know, it is a kind of a miserable experience, but I guess it's clearly designed that way. So that's the thing. It's like, why? And I ultimately didn't really feel like I could find enough justification to warrant sitting through this 4 hours, or God forbid you watch the whole thing, like 5 hour experience. Like I just didn't get a lot out of it. For all that I put in, I didn't get much out of it. And like, it's not like I'm a Lars von Trier neophyte. I know what I'm getting into here. I was looking forward to this movie when I heard about it. And a lot of his movies are very dark and depressing and bleak. But I think most of them are more focused. They're more, you know, this movie really does feel like he's kind of wandering around, noodling around, looking for these points. And occasionally he makes one. He makes a bunch of them. It's 4 hours. He's going to make a couple of points in 4 hours. But that it just, you know, I think that if you had watched, I basically watched them in one long marathon. And maybe if you watch them separately, that might have been, you know, like maybe splitting this movie in half was a good choice, because it just kind of dilutes the length a little bit and helps you kind of focus in on those moments that really do work. But I don't know. Did this movie really need to be 4 or potentially 5 hours long? I don't really know that it did. I feel like, you know, he could have perhaps made a 2 hour or 2.5 hour Nymphomaniac that might have been a lot closer to a Melancholia or an Antichrist in terms of a stronger, kind of more coherent vision.
Yeah, you know, I feel just generally a little bemused by this movie, though I think I like it a bit more than you do. But I was not
be hard to like it less.
I was not bored when I was watching it, but I did feel like it, as much as I do feel like it raises some interesting and kind of pointed ideas about about being an outsider, like being inherently an outsider, and about embracing that versus attempting to fit in, or about being kind of punished for not fitting in. I think like it floats a lot of those ideas in a way. I agree that I think that Lars von Trier has a deep sense of connection to that. But for the most part, this movie felt to me like it was recycling a lot of the themes that Antichrist and Melancholia did better. And he sees this as the third in that trilogy of despair, or whatever it is he's calling it. But I felt like, you know, there's one part in the movie when she's seeing Jamie Bell's character, and there's this theme of like child endangerment because she leaves her son behind and without a caretaker. And it's basically the beginning of Antichrist. And I felt like it was just, you know, revisiting and running through the very same, almost the exact same scene, with a slightly different outcome, without ever really exploring it. I mean, like the idea of actually digging into being a mother, or being unfit to be a mother, because you can't stop chasing your own personal desires, is like a very fraught and kind of dark and rich one. But the movie doesn't get that far into it. You know, it touches on it, and it maybe sort of revisits it with the scene with the kind of storylines with Mia Goth, but not really, you know. And I don't know, I did feel like it was, rather than covering a lot of new territory, it was stepping back into,
it was covering a lot of nude territory instead.
That's nice. Yeah. It was stepping back into a lot of the themes that were covered better in Antichrist
in previous movies by Lars von Trier.
Yeah.
I would agree with that. All right. Well, I think that's going to wrap it up. That is our discussion of Nymphomaniac Volumes 1 and 2, which you can watch both of right now on Netflix. All right. Before we do Behind the 8-Ball, let's get to Singer and Wilmore's Completely Concise and Totally Succinct New Release Roundup, where we very briefly just run down some of the new movies in theaters. We've actually seen quite a few that are coming out this Friday as you're listening to this. Allison, where do you want to start first?
Let's start with Exodus, Gods and Kings.
Exodus,
the masterpiece. Of
Snoring
the
of the People.
Yeah, this movie is really bad.
It's not good.
It's bad.
It's not good.
Yeah. I don't know. Who do you think was the funniest in terms of the weird, much discussed now casting of white actors?
The race bending or whatever.
In the major roles. Who do you think was the most out of place?
Oh, John Turturro for sure.
As Pharaoh,
and not even attempting. You know, like most of the people, it's sort of like a Nymphomaniac where you have people giving British accents, which is even weirder in Exodus, of course, because they're all Middle Eastern, but they're all speaking with British accents. You have John Turturro's talking in his normal voice as the Pharaoh, and you two brothers will be together forever. I just thought he looked. And I didn't know he was in it. So when he showed up with the bald head and the Egyptian
and the
cat's
eyeliner,
eye makeup,
yeah.
I was hysterical. I will say at that moment, I was kind of excited because I thought this was going to be a train wreck. And it's not. It's just
bad.
It's just boring.
It's so humorless.
Yeah. Other than John Turturro, basically. There's one scene where Joel Edgerton milks snakes for their venom, which is hilarious.
Yeah.
But really, other than those two scenes, I mean, I felt like I was watching someone who had said, okay, the Ten Commandments is like a consistent moneymaker by being on television, but it's getting old. The effects are really dated. The whole thing about it is dated. So let's just do an update and let's do like the quote unquote grim and gritty reboot where it's a lot darker. The colors aren't as beautiful and vivid. It's not a Technicolor masterpiece. It is like,
there's more battles.
It's like there's like a sequence that feels like it's straight out of Gladiator. There's a sequence that feels like it's straight out of Ridley Scott's Robin Hood. There's a lot of like the greatest hits of Ridley Scott in this movie. And yeah, it just doesn't add up to anything. It is just super boring.
The thing that's like most, I think, annoying and upsetting about, you know, he did an interview with Variety where he said something along the lines of like, you know, a movie of this size, like using Spanish tax credits, like I couldn't have it star like Mohammed
so-and-so
from such and such.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't even on the table.
Right.
And you're like, well,
okay,
even
but then,
if that's true on the market forces, why did you need to make this movie?
Why did you like? Okay, Christian Bale, sure, he's a movie star. He's a box office draw. Is Joel Edgerton a box office draw?
Yeah. Well, and it's also just like it is not an important movie, and it's not like a deeply personal movie.
No,
it's not like it seems so calculated.
Right.
It seems like such a calculated like fanboy crowd meets potential faith-based crowd.
Right.
Like. Yeah.
Yeah. The one thing I think the only way that I think you can defend the casting, which was as I was watching in the beginning, like John Turturro, totally ridiculous, but it did kind of remind me of the Ten Commandments, of those old school epics, which you could counter and say were very racist to begin with, and you're perpetrating, carrying on stereotypes.
Right.
But I would say that I only got that vibe in the first like 20 minutes or so. And then it didn't feel like that after a while, because they do try to suck all of the kind of supernaturalness out of the movie and create this justification for all the different plagues and such. So I sort of thought the only way they could have justified it, they kind of threw away after the first 20 minutes.
Well, yeah. And also I feel like if you were just going to abandon it and be like, this is not realistic, it's some kind of race blind vision of this, but like race clearly exists in it. They go out of their way to cast all of the background extras and the slaves and the many of the supporting characters as actors of color.
Yes.
And so it's not, and then suddenly when you get to the main characters, they're white people in bronzer.
That's very problematic,
you know. And I feel like that's one thing where it's not like, oh, you know, race, we're not paying attention to race here.
Right.
It's that specifically race exists except when it comes to main characters.
I think that's a very fair criticism.
Yeah.
So let my people go see another movie, basically.
Yes. Exodus. Yeah. Maybe even top five.
Okay. Now I haven't seen this one.
You haven't seen this yet. I have seen it and I really like it. It's funny. It's personal. It's profane. It's another movie in which about a creative person struggling with wanting to make a serious project,
right,
after having established in this case himself as a guy who makes broad, you know, stupid, profane
soulless
comedies.
Mainstream comedies.
He's famous for a series of movies called Hammy the Bear, which he plays in a bear suit. I think he's like a cop.
A bear cop?
I think so. You see clips of them.
Right.
And like, it's made him super famous. Mm-hmm. And when the movie starts, he's just about to premiere his first attempt at serious acting, in which he plays like a Haitian slave rebellion leader. When you see clips of that, it's also very clear that the movie is horrible.
Right.
And also, so it's
perhaps
most
like Birdman in that sense.
Yeah. And most of the movie is him walking around with a New York Times reporter played by Rosario Dawson, mm-hmm. who's like interviewing him and shadowing him for that day.
Right.
And this is, it's in parts, this movie is a little like Before Sunset. It's a lot of walking and talking. Yeah. And it's also like a very kind of flirty, edgy romance between mm-hmm. the two. And like, but he's also getting married.
Right. To a reality show star.
Yeah. It covers a lot of territory. It's very lively. It's got some great cameos that I won't spoil. It looks to me,
I haven't seen it, but the trailer, I mean, the vibe I was getting was Woody Allen Stardust Memories.
Definitely.
Down to the fact that his character's name is Andre Allen, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me that he's very deliberately doing that.
It's definitely got some Woody Allen to it as well. I mean, I think the thing that's the most enjoyable aspect of this is it feels like such a Chris Rock movie. His voice is so clear.
Yeah, that's good.
You know, and I think in a way where he's like a big film nerd too.
Yeah.
You know, and he's a very smart guy, and it's been great reading the interview he did for New York Magazine and the letter he wrote for Hollywood Reporter. You're just like, it's great to hear Chris Rock's voice come through because he's got a great voice.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of that one.
Cool. Cool. All right. Let's get to Behind the Eight Ball. Let's do it. Let's run down 3 new releases, 2 listener recommendations, and 1 film chosen blindly by number from our My Lists. That's what we do every episode to close out the show. Allison, you want to go first?
I will go first.
All right. Let's begin with 3 new titles.
Okay. First up is, I'm sure a lot of people have been talking about this one already, Black Mirror, which is new to Netflix, the British TV show, which is really, I think, some of the best and most unconventional television that's been made this decade, and also some of the best sci-fi. Created by Charlie Brooker, who is one of the writers on Brass Eye. He's the creator of the miniseries Dead Set, which combines zombies and the show Big Brother. And Black Mirror is currently 6 episodes long, though there's a 7th that's going to air on TV this month. But it's an anthology series like The Twilight Zone. I mean, that's the easiest comparison, but all dealing with technology and possible futures, some kind of further away from where we are, and some just like very painfully close. It's cynical, but smart, and just each of these episodes, but each of these episodes kind of gets at something very profound about our relationship with technology, and in a very kind of concentrated dose. I'd say particularly good ones are Be Right Back, which kind of does Her before Her was made, and The Entire History of You, which is about, it's kind of like a Google Glass almost device where you're allowed to record all your history and kind of revisit it. And both of those episodes are terrific. And the new one that's coming out for Christmas, Merry Christmas, is White Christmas, starring John Hamm. I think it's airing in the UK first, but it's going to air in the US on DirecTV on like the 26th. So if you have DirecTV, you'll be able to watch that. New to Hulu is Cannibal Girls, which is mostly a reminder of humble beginnings. This is one of Ivan Reitman's earliest films from 1973. It is a Canadian schlock horror comedy type thing about 3 women who are in a cannibal cult and who prey upon travelers. And it stars Eugene Levy and Andrea Martin.
Just who you would cast in that kind of a movie.
Right. And when it was in theaters, they had this William Castle style gimmick in which a warning bell would sound before a scene of gore, which is unfortunately not in the video. But yeah, Reitman would go on to direct Meatballs, Stripes, and then Ghostbusters. So, you know, you have to start somewhere. So that's Cannibal Girls on Hulu. And finally, new to Netflix is The One I Love, which is directed by Charlie McDowell and stars Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss as a couple who head to a weekend getaway at a beautiful house in the country on the recommendation of their therapist, played by Ted Danson. And this is one of 2 movies this year that have made really good use of minimal special effects and just like a smart kind of sci-fi-ish premise. The other one I would say is coherence. But it's just very cleverly done, and it features a cast of three people, and uses this sci-fi-ish premise or fantasy premise to get at a couple's marital problems in a way that I think works very well. That's one I love on Netflix.
All right. How about two listener recommendations?
Okay. Genevieve from Toronto recommends Denis Villeneuve's Polytechnique, which is available on iTunes and Amazon. She writes, I have been thinking about this movie lately because December 6, 2014 marks 25 years since the real life tragedy in which 14 women from a Montreal engineering school were killed by a shooter who stated wanting to kill as many feminists as possible because they ruined his life. Villeneuve has fictionalized some of the people we encounter in this story. He did not want to tell the exact life story of any of the victims, creating instead some amalgams. However, this doesn't diminish the heartbreaking nature of the story. The use of black and white photography and an overall quiet tone make the outbursts of violence all the more powerful. Upon its release in 2009, it drew comparisons to Gus Van Sant's Elephant by its narrative structure and subject matter. But I think that because it's more focused on the victims and survivors rather than the killer, it has something else to bring to the table. Glad to see Denis Villeneuve's profile has been rising internationally in recent years because he has long been one of my favorite Quebec directors, partly on the strength of this movie. And then Patricia writes, after listening to our episode on biblical movies, since I'm a pastor and have lots of feelings about how the Bible is represented in film, this prompts my first ever recommendations email to you. She has one recommendation that's not available on streaming, Denis Arcand's Jesus of Montreal, but another one is, she writes, I'd also like to recommend another French language film, Violette, from 2013, by director Martin Provost. This film stars Emmanuel Davos as Violette Leduc, a writer championed by Simone de Beauvoir. Leduc was the first woman to write with frankness about having an abortion, and was a pioneer in women's writing about their own sexuality. She's portrayed as a brilliant but highly strung woman whose passions were larger than life and largely unrequited, but who ultimately, after a long struggle, comes into her own as a voice of the women's movement. The movie is fascinating and entertaining, and the performances are just stunning. And Violette is streaming on Netflix.
That's cool. I love those recommendations. Okay, and one from your My List.
You gave me number two.
Yes.
Which is the most recent ones up there. And my number two is The Big Knife. This is a 1955 film noir directed by Robert Aldrich, starring Jack Palance and Ida Lupino, who was a filmmaker in her own right at a time when women didn't really get to do that. And this actually feels particularly in line with this year's films about people wanting to make serious art. Palance plays an actor who is trying to avoid signing another multi-year contract with his studio because he wants to make better movies, and he's also trying to save his marriage to Lupino. But he's being blackmailed by the studio head who has information about a hit and run that he was involved with, and he's trying to get him to sign back on to make these schlocky movies. That sounds great.
What was the reason you added it? Is it because that they were doing The Big Knife on Broadway recently? Did you know that?
I was looking for Ida Lupino work, and it's actually the only thing
that Netflix has right now.
Yes.
I'm not sure I think the show might be over, but they were just recently did The Big Knife.
Really?
The Roundabout Theater Company. Yeah, Broadway. Yeah, I'm not sure if it's still. Yeah, it was last year, I guess. I'm looking it up right now. Yeah, it ended last summer. But yeah, just recently they did it on Broadway. So yeah.
Oh. Well, Matt, are you ready?
Yes.
All right, three new picks.
And I just added The Big Knife to my my list as well, because that's one I think I saw it once, but I'd like to revisit it. All right, first up from my list, the most important film to hit streaming in 2014, Arnold Schwarzenegger's Sabotage. The film is basically a 10 Little Indians-style mystery set in an elite DEA unit. This group steals a bunch of money from a drug cartel, the money goes missing, and then one by one, the members of the unit start turning up dead. Who could be responsible? Could it be Arnold Schwarzenegger as Special Agent John Breacher Wharton? I'm not telling. You'll have to watch the movie. In all sincerity, it's not a masterpiece. I will concede that. I do like writer-director David Ayer quite a bit. I think he's a good filmmaker. I think he has a knack for capturing sort of the real gritty brotherhood of soldiers or you know, cops, warriors. That's sort
he
of
likes
his
dudes hanging out.
Dudes hanging out. Yeah, that's sort of always the best parts of his movies. This has a little more plot than he usually does, but the dudes hanging out stuff is pretty good. And I will say that the last scene of the film, or the last sequence, couple of scenes, are some of the most fascinating in Arnold Schwarzenegger's career. I really believe that. And I think the ending alone, if you're an Arnold fan, makes Sabotage worth watching, worth thinking about. So that's Sabotage. It's streaming on Netflix. Streaming on Amazon Prime is We Need to Talk About Kevin, Lynn Ramsey's extremely dark film about a woman, played by the amazing Tilda Swinton, who is dealing with the aftermath of a brutal crime committed by her teenage son. The movie is set after the crimes, as Swinton's character becomes a pariah in her hometown, but it repeatedly flashes back to show Kevin's childhood and his tortured relationship with his mother and the rest of his family. It's a very disturbing movie, but Swinton's performance is really incredible. I'd say that's the thing that makes it worth this journey through some very bleak subject matter. Sort of Nymphomaniac X in that it's sort of so dark. But
well,
I feel like
also dealing with the idea of worrying that you're unfit to be a mother.
Yes, yeah.
In a way, it digs much more into that than Nymphomaniac does.
It does indeed. That you're right. That is a theme in Nymphomaniac. I like We Need to Talk About Kevin a lot more. That is worth watching. That is streaming on Amazon Prime. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention? I've just been handed an urgent and horrifying news story. I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen. Anchorman 2 and Anchorman 2, the supersized edition, are both streaming on Netflix and Amazon Prime. In this brilliant, monumental, towering work of fiction, Ron Burgundy is back, along with the rest of his Channel 4 news team, and they are transplanted from San Diego to New York, where they help birth 24-hour news on cable and, as the movie kind of hilariously argues, essentially destroy the future of democracy. There was really only one movie, Allison, from 2013 that I saw three times in the movie theater, and it was Anchorman 2. I saw the original version twice, and then when they released that supersized cut with a ton of new jokes as rated R, I went back and I saw that as well. So I saw it three times in the movie theater. The shorter version is the superior version, but there is some good stuff in the R-rated version as well. So I would say watch the theatrical version, and if you liked it, then double dip and go watch the extended cut. So Anchorman 2 and Anchorman 2, the supersized edition, streaming now on both Netflix and Amazon Prime.
All right. Two listener recommendations.
Our first comes from Jordan in Joliet, Illinois. He says, "Hello, Matt and Allison. I am a huge fan of the show and have been listening since SVU began. In honor of your recent female anti-heroine list, I am recommending Saving Grace, the TNT series, which you can stream now on Netflix. Allison commented in the podcast there is a lack of high-quality TV dramas featuring anti-heroines, and while I don't know if this would be considered high-quality TV drama, it at least fits that theme. Have you seen Saving Grace?"
I have not, actually.
Well, this is one you can stream now on Netflix. Jordan also has additional recommendations. As an avid podcast listener, I've become a huge fan of Kumail Nanjiani's The X-Files Files, and the entire series is available to stream on Netflix. I assume he means The X-Files itself is available to stream on Netflix as well. The podcast reviews episodes and provides analysis and interviews with those involved in the show. This definitely has reignited my erstwhile crush on the babelicious David Duchovny. To convince you of his hotness, I have attached the most amazing picture of him ever. Matt, I apologize. You don't have to apologize. It is an amazing picture.
Everyone likes David Duchovny.
He's a very handsome man. Absolutely. Are you an X-Files fan, Allison?
I am. I was a big X-Files fan.
We've had that podcast recommended to us as well from other people.
A lot of people are a big fan of this. I love Kumail Nanjiani. I have added a new podcast to my rotation for a while. It's a little full at the moment, but I feel like I should try and make room for it.
Yeah, I didn't watch the show when it was on. When it was added to Netflix, I did add it, and I started watching it. I was like, oh, this show is really good, but that's a lot to do. Yeah, it's up like 7, 9, 10, 14 seasons of 22 episodes each. It's a lot to dive into. Let me just put this question to you, Allison, very quickly.
Yes.
If you were to create a podcast about just one show as the X-Files Files is, what show would you choose? Totally, I put you on the spot here.
Yeah, no, it's a good question, because I feel like the thing is, there are shows that I really enjoy, but you wouldn't have much to say about. Right. So you want something that's kind of naughty and
meaty,
that has like meaty and that. Yeah. I don't know. Deadwood, maybe. I really like Deadwood.
That's a good choice.
Yeah.
It's a very good choice.
I mean, and a lot of other shows haven't gone on long enough, you know,
right.
Or don't have enough episodes. You need
that's
something
another
that's
qualification.
Got a few seasons.
Yeah.
Not if you're like, okay, that's been all five episodes of this show. The end.
Right.
Thanks for subscribing to our podcast.
Right.
No, yeah.
That's a good answer.
I don't know.
Like
how about you?
I don't know if there would be enough to just, maybe Seinfeld. Maybe Seinfeld. Be interesting to go back because I haven't really been watching it very much. I used to really rewatch it over and over and over again, and it's been a while since I've done that. Be interesting to do that now, I think, perhaps. I don't know if there's enough meat there to discuss, but maybe there would be.
You could double up.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was a recommendation from Jordan in Joliet, Illinois. That was Saving Grace on Netflix and The X-Files on Netflix, as well as the X-Files Files podcast. Finally, we've got a recommendation here from Vanessa V. She says, as you mentioned, the anti-heroine is alive and well on television, and I wanted to mention something that belongs in the pantheon of TV anti-heroines, American Horror Story Coven, which is going to be released on Netflix Instant on December 6th. I also wanted to mention Orphan Black Seasons 1 and 2, which are streaming on Amazon Prime, which feature a number of complicated female characters, most of which are more heroic than anti-heroic, but at least a few of them are morally ambiguous as well. Love the Batman Returns discussion. Keep up the great work from Vanessa. I have not watched any of American Horror Story, Allison. Not sure if that's quite my bag. Do you think I would like it?
I really liked Asylum, the second season.
The different each season is like its own thing.
It's its
correct?
Own story. Okay. There are sometimes recurring actors. Coven, I stuck with, but it didn't really do it for me. And I've jumped ship on this new season.
You bailed.
Yeah, Freak Show, which started off very promisingly and then just kind of lost me.
Okay. And Orphan Black, I watched the first episode of that and thought it looked, I thought it was great. Here was the problem.
Yes.
Thought my wife would like it, wanted to watch it with her. We haven't had time to watch it together.
I've only seen the first season of Orphan Black, but I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah. That's one we're definitely going to get to at some point.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Maybe this Christmas break, we'll be able to start watching that one. Okay. So those were American Horror Story Coven coming to Netflix on December 6th. And Orphan Black Seasons 1 and 2 on Amazon Prime from Vanessa. Thank you, Vanessa.
All right, one from your Netflix My List.
You gave me number one, the very top of my list. And I'll preface it by saying they've just added a whole bunch of new 30 for 30 documentaries, the sports doc series to Netflix. So it's just one of those is my number one right now. I have like five at the top of my list. But number one is 30 for 30, Bernie and Ernie. And the plot description here is one of the first African-American players at Tennessee, that would be the University of Tennessee, Bernard King, gained national acclaim alongside his talented teammate, Ernie Grunfeld. And I assume the doc is about the two of them. I love 30 for 30s. I've already watched a few of the new ones they added. I'm trying to think which ones I watched. Let me look real quick. I watched one that was like Playing for the Mob. And it was all about the real story of the point shaving scandal that they mention in Goodfellas, and it was narrated by Ray Liotta, and everyone in the movie is lying. The real Henry Hill is interviewed in it.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah, that was really good. And I've watched a few other of the more recent 30 for 30s. Almost all of the docs in that series are worth watching. If you haven't seen them, check them out. So 30 for 30, Bernie and Ernie is my number one in my list right now. All right, so this is the part of the show we would normally go through our options for our Listener's Choice Review on our next episode, but we are not going to do a Listener's Choice Review on our next episode. Don't panic. Don't panic. Everything's fine, but next episode is going to be our big year-end blowout. We're going to do the Spoovies, our usual year-end awards where we give, you know, everyone gives the best actor and best actress. We do weird awards. That's our specialty. So it'd be like the best actress who only has one eye or, you know, something like that. That would be more up our alley. I don't know who that would be.
I was like, it sounded so specific, but you didn't have
I didn't have an example.
Mind.
It was totally off the cuff, which was a mistake, but I'm not going to go back. We're just going to plow ahead. So, yeah. So, you know, we've done in the past, I'm trying to think of what are the categories we actually do. We've done like best trailer. We've done our favorite movie of 2015 where we try to anticipate next year's movies. I can't wait to go back and listen to last year's episode and find out what we thought would be the best film of the year. I will definitely hold our feet to the fire on that for sure. But we usually have a whole bunch of those. Plus, we'll have a more traditional sort of best of the year. Last year, I think, Allison, you abstained because you were deep in TV criticism land.
I was, yes.
This year, you're much more prepared. So we'll have fun going through our picks, perhaps arguing over those. Giving out the Spoovies, that should definitely take up a good amount of time. We will not have time for a Listener's Choice Review, but we will have one on the following episode after that.
Yes, and that episode, our year-end blowout, will go up on or around Tuesday, December 23rd, very close to Christmas. But
my birthday
and your birthday. Until then, you can always follow us on Twitter at FilmSpottingSVU. And you can also check us out at FilmSpottingSVU.com, where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discuss on the show. The Film Spotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal, and you can listen to more of Vince's work at VinceVandal.com. And we will be back in 2 weeks with the Swoovie Awards. And in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Allison Wilmore and at Matt Singer. And you can follow the show at Film Spotting SVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice, except not this time. And, you know, where we share more streaming suggestions from you guys. And of course, we always, you know, appreciate and need to fill out that section, your streaming recommendations.
Yes.
So if there's something that you've watched recently that you like on streaming, please do send it in. You don't need to write too much, though we always appreciate it when you tell us what you liked about mm-hmm. this. But, you know, short ones are great too.
Short and sweet.
Yes. And you can send those to us at SVU at filmspottingsvu.com.
Let's do this. How about this? How about instead of the listener's choice poll, we'll put up like a best film of the year poll. We'll put a few options. We'll leave you another so you can, we can read that on the show. The listeners can give out a swoovie as well.
Excellent.
That's a good idea.
That sounds
good. And we've also gotten a few iTunes review recently. Thank you to everyone who's left positive iTunes reviews for the show, and there were like no negative ones. I was so excited.
Yay.
Because then I didn't have to fall into like a rage spiral.
I know.
So that was great.
Cry a bit and be like, rend your hair, your garments.
Tweet angrily and self-loathingly. Yeah, it gets pretty ugly, but I didn't have to do that because there was lots of nice reviews. Thank you to everyone who's left us a positive review on iTunes. Definitely do that. If you haven't done it, it helps us reach more listeners. It's very important.
Yeah. Well, for Film Spotting SVU, I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. Thanks for listening.